Welcome to the EI Podcast. I'm Paul Lay, Senior Editor at Engelsberg Ideas. And today, I'm delighted to be joined by Michael Osslyn, a Distinguished Fellow at Stanford's Hoover Institution, who has written widely on US foreign policy, particularly in Asia, geopolitics, and the intellectual history of the United States. And in light of America's 250th anniversary, which we've just marked, his latest book, National Treasure, How the Declaration of Independence Made America, engages with current debates about US identity, democracy, and America's role in the world. Michael, welcome to the EI Podcast.
Thank you for having me, Paul.
The Declaration must be just about one of the most studied documents in history. Apart from the obvious that it's the 250th anniversary, what made you write this book now? And why did you feel that it was the Declaration rather than, say, the Constitution or the Civil War that deserves this renewed attention? Why this document deserves its own biography?
Well, I mean, the truth is I wanted to read this book, and no one had yet written it, shockingly to me, despite dozens and dozens of books on the Declaration and, of course, on the founding moment and the war, the Revolutionary War and the like. No one had yet written a complete history of America's founding document, not just at the moment of its birth and the moment of its dissemination to the world and to Americans, but throughout our history. Honestly, that's sort of where I started. Is I thought, well, if no one's written this thing, I guess I better write it myself. But I also stumbled across the idea about 2 years ago, and I realized, well, we were coming up on the 250th. I remember the 200th, and the excitement that was surrounding it. I mean, it was a very difficult time coming out of Vietnam and Watergate and the wars, but still, there was an enormous amount of excitement, and it seemed to me this time the 250th, the lead up to it, just seemed so much more conflicted, I guess is the way I would put it. Obviously we're a very divided society, though again, we were divided in 1976. A deeply unpopular president and had just left office 2 years before in 1976. But, you know, we have a very polarizing president. People either love him or hate him. I mean, there seemed to be a lot of parallels. And yet I wasn't seeing the sort of historical treatment of either all of our history or, quite frankly, the Declaration that I remembered from the last go around. And so I said, well, if I'm going to do it, I better do it really quickly. And what it turned into was a full exploration, really, of the American story through the Declaration's history. So things you just mentioned, the Constitution, the Civil War, you can go on, immigration, civil rights, World War I, World War II, the Cold War, all of that's in there. But it's in there through the lens of the Declaration, which I honestly didn't realize was so central to all of these issues and all of these debates. So it became a journey for me of discovery as much as trying to tell the story simply because I wanted to know it.
It was a complete revelation to me, so much of it. I mean, I thought I was reasonably familiar with the history of the United States, but a lot of this was completely new to me. And it's a rather picaresque tale in parts. And I think I get the sense that it's a very personal one for you as well.
It was. I guess, you know, you get to a certain stage in life and you start looking back and trying to understand, you know, your own life within the context of your society and of your nation. And you know, it's not that we, like everyone else, don't love to talk about ourselves and talk about what we've been through. But I certainly felt that compared to when I was a kid, it seemed. And again, it was a difficult time in the 1970s, for both the U.S. and its European allies and Asian allies. But it seemed to me that our history was so much more contested today, in ways that in many ways in which I didn't agree with, that I felt it was just, you know, people were contesting it for contestation's sake as opposed to legitimate historical reasons, which isn't, of course, to say you don't keep looking back at your history and you don't keep trying to reassess it. But I think there was an attitude of, look, you know, the more we can take down, the more we can knock off a pedestal, the more we can make it, you know, controversial, the better it is. And I think that does a disservice to the historical profession, because that's not always what the history itself indicates. And in fact, one of the themes, if not the great theme to me of this book, was that I believe the Declaration is our great statement of unity. And again, that doesn't mean that we haven't been divided or we're not divided or there weren't terrible things, of course, that had to be remedied. All of that was. But the more I looked at how the Declaration played out in our history, the more I came to appreciate what I saw as its message of unity, a message that I didn't think I was superimposing on the past, but rather one that the people in the past, Americans at different points in time, openly adopted and reflected referred to, that they wanted to be part of this great nation. Today, you know, we often think of ourselves as these warring tribes, that, you know, there's no agreement among us, and that everyone simply wants their own, you know, their own set of special privileges and carving off enclaves and the like. But when you go back through the most contested issues of our history, slavery, women's rights, immigration, in fact, what I found was that all of these groups were attempting to become fully American, not to separate themselves from the broader society or the great stream of American history, but to say we have a right to be part of it and to participate in that. And what they always referred to repeatedly was the Declaration. And so I learned from them that division was not the normal state of the American polity or American society. No matter how divided we were, what always was in the foreground was this hope to make, as it is put in the Constitution, a more perfect union, a more inclusive union, a union of opportunity. And while those debates and those battles, of course, were fought on constitutional grounds, often legal grounds, the spirit behind them all was the Declaration. And so that became a fascinating and quite frankly, inspiring part of the American story that I wanted to tell. And you know, I'm unabashed about it, you know. I love America, even though I fully recognize we're not perfect. To love it, or quite frankly, to say it's great, doesn't mean that it's perfect. It doesn't mean that it hasn't had traumatic problems that have had to be solved, and that it doesn't have problems today. But if you hate your country and you hate your neighbors and you hate your fellow citizens, where do you go? What's the answer? And instead, what I found was that at all of these points in our history, people were referring to the Declaration as the great hope. Frederick Douglass said that, you know, what to the slave is the 4th of July in his famous address of 1852. And he ends it by saying, but I don't give up hope because of the Declaration. And so this to me was incredibly inspiring. And yes, I wrote it in a way for those kids that I was in 1976, so that maybe they could love the Declaration as well and learn from it and try to make a better and more perfect union.
I wonder if we can go back to the beginning of all of this, Michael, and look at the atmosphere in which the Declaration and everything else around it came about. Go back a little further to the Seven Years' War and how this led to the Revolutionary War, and get some sort of flavor of the time of its composition.
Sure. You know, the truth is that the vast majority of British Americans in our 13 colonies didn't want to leave the empire. They were proud of being British. They were proud of being Englishmen with ancient rights that they exercised on this continent with their own representative assemblies, what they called their constitutions. That the salutary neglect, as Edmund Burke put it, of the crown and parliament towards the colonies allowed them to be fully British, but also to be fully American. And that began to change, ironically, with the spectacular victory in the Seven Years' War, in which, by the way, it was started by a young Virginian named George Washington, when he, acting as part of the Virginia militia under British orders, ambushed a French and Indian patrol and brigade, basically, in the woods, and then lost the ensuing battle that came after that. This was a spectacular victory that basically secured the North American continent for the crown and for the empire. So it should have been the height of America's participation in imperial affairs, but the cost of it, the necessity of continuing now and expanding the garrisons to protect those now even expanded borders to the west. We often think about this in terms of the Atlantic, but what really concerned the colonists was the west. This was an untamed, unsettled continent that stretched. They didn't even know how far it stretched. Turns out it stretched for about 3,000 miles. They had no idea, but they did know that you had to now garrison this against the Indians, against the French, who had, you know, still were controlling parts of the continent, though not the rich and settled eastern parts anymore. And so the crown decided that the colonists should have to pay a little bit, which was not unreasonable. But the way that it was done was tone deaf, and it was insulting, and ultimately became unreasonable. And in a very short period of time, in the space of a decade, this unfortunately irrevocable rift, this untraversable chasm had been opened up between London and its various colonies. And we have to remember, of course, the colonies were completely separate. And in their own view, they weren't sovereign in their own views, but they were completely independent of each other, not of the crown, but of each other. And so, you know, someone in Massachusetts or the main territory of Massachusetts was as different from someone in Virginia as they were from a Frenchman or a Spaniard. I mean, this you know, they had almost never interacted beyond the basics of some trade and some exchange of information. But it was what they considered to be the increasingly heavy and unnecessarily heavy hand of London that began to push them together. Of course, we're all familiar with taxation without representation as sort of the rallying cry. And what we forget is that behind the scenes and often in front of the scenes, there were so many different attempts to repair this relationship, to say, well, of course, we'll pay something, but it has to be voluntary. Or the crown has a right to regulate trade, for example, but not to levy internal taxes. And this was going on back and forth over this decade in which at every stage, the colonists, who were fully aware of their weakness, their smallness, their distance from the metropole, were trying to figure out ways that their own sense of their rights and their liberties could be respected, but that they would contribute and show that they were contributing to the Parliament, to Crown, by, you know, through whatever they were going to give, in order to acknowledge that what had happened in the Seven Years' War, what we call the French and Indian War, was legitimate. They weren't ignoring it. But it didn't work out that way. And, you know, a combination of pride, of arrogance on the part of both sides, you know, both sides of the Atlantic, ultimately led to this period really starting in 1774 with the colonists called the Intolerable Acts, which were imposed on Massachusetts after the Boston Tea Party, that really brought the colonies together so that you could have a Virginian, a Cavalier, Patrick Henry, state, I am not a Virginian, I am an American. And then, of course, most famously, give me liberty or give me death, which was a little histrionic, and yet they had been pushed into this corner so that by the time of Lexington and Concord, even as they hoped for reconciliation, this dawning dread amongst them was that they might have to go their own way in the world, which was an inconceivable step. No one had done it. How could you? Why would you separate from the most powerful empire at the time? Could you survive? Would you be at the mercy of other great powers like France and Spain? And yet, step by irrevocable step, they were pushed to it. And by July 2nd of 1776, not all the opposition had been overcome, but the effective political opposition realized that independence was now something that was inevitable. And the real issue was no longer would you be independent or not, but how are you going to be independent?
Now, the subtitle of your book, I think it's very interesting that it says that the Declaration made America. It's a bold claim, I think, and a stronger claim than saying it founded America. And I wonder if that distinction is a pointed one, and what you mean by that, if so, that it made rather than founded America.
I firmly believe that the Declaration made America, that without the Declaration, nothing else could have followed. And so there is, of course, a strong academic argument that the Constitution of 1787 refounded the United States. In essence, it was a second founding. And, you know, from an intellectual angle, that's not incorrect. But when you look at the Constitution, the debates over the Constitution, and of course, the inclusion ultimately of the first 10 amendments, the Bill of Rights, all of that is deriving from the Declaration, from what had been stated implicitly and explicitly in the Declaration. So back then, nobody paid attention to what we pay attention to today, the great lines, you know, the greatest sentence ever written, according to Walter Isaacson. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, and among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. No one paid attention to that. They ignored it. They ignored that. They ignored the ending in which the signers pledged to each other their lives, their fortunes, and their sacred honor. What they focused on were the 27 grievances, the charges. And these were lawyers who drew it up. Thomas Jefferson was a lawyer, and many of those in the Congress were lawyers. And they felt you had to lay out the case of why you had taken this step. And by the way, the Declaration did not claim independence. Independence had already been declared 2 days before. It was an administrative announcement saying, this is what we've done. Not through this document. We've already taken our vote. This is not the instrument of our independence, but this is the instrument that explains our independence. And so it was the grievances. And the Declaration was explicitly written so as not to be a governing document. It did not say what type of government should be set up. That was left for the Committee for the Articles of Confederation. And then, of course, as we know, those were too weak. So 13 years later, actually 11 years later, you are thrown into the Constitutional Convention. But at the convention, the spirit of what the Declaration and the explicit statements of the grievances showed how an illegitimate government should not act, in this case, Crown and Parliament, and therefore, by implication, how a legitimate government should act. And that was what the Constitutional Convention was trying to come to grips with. How do you form that legitimate government? And a number of prominent voices from 1776 warned in 1787 that what we were heading towards was simply the very type of system that we had rebelled against in 76, a centralized government that was going to take away our liberties. And some of those who had been the strongest voices, Patrick Henry, for example, in 1776, refused to sign. They became what was known as anti-federalists, refused to approve and sign the Constitution. And even the inclusion of the Bill of Rights directly coming from the spirit of the grievances of the Declaration, that these are how we are going to protect our ancient liberties, did not sway those on the anti-federalist side. And so without the Declaration, we wouldn't have had the Constitution, we wouldn't have had the Bill of Rights, we wouldn't have had the idea of amendments. But there's something deeper that goes beyond this, which is that about 40 to 50 years after the signing of the Declaration, it becomes an object both of inspiration for those who are trying to reform a rapidly growing, beginning to industrialize slowly, certainly expanding country, as well as change the vision of those who have been here for decades and who have been essentially accepting of the system, to recognizing that there is more to this American experiment than what was expressed in 1776. So the idea now that we're very comfortable with, but which was sort of radical for them back then, was to say, what did Jefferson mean by all men are created equal? The Declaration didn't talk about slaves or blacks. It wasn't talking about women. It wasn't talking about American Indians. It was a question, ultimately, did that include all immigrants? Did they have to be immigrants that we understood because they were coming from the British Isles or from Germany or let's say or Sweden, places where we had immigrants? What about different types of immigrants who were starting to come to this country in the 1830s and 1840s? Those who were driven by the Revolution of 1848 in Europe, the revolutions, right? Suddenly you had Central Europeans coming, Hungarians and Poles and people who had never been part of this country. And so a new set of questions had to be tackled by this country that already, just 50 years later, was beginning to change rather dramatically. And that's really the story of America, is constant change within a defined framework. And that defined framework was the Declaration and the Constitution after it. So they began to ask these questions. And at each stage, whether it was utopian socialists in 1826 or women suffragettes in 1848 or abolitionists in 1852, and of course through that entire period, they began to ask, what did the Declaration mean? How do we live up to its promises, in essence, without a wholesale overthrowing of the system, but rather an expansion of the system? And that, I believe, is what truly made America. And those debates continued through the 19th century into the 20th century and quite frankly, to the 21st century.
It's very interesting when you talk about the grievances, I think. It reminds me of the way we look at another profound historical document, which is Magna Carta, which is very much rooted in very specific grievances, long forgotten now, but which has this patina of universal principles. And I think there's something there about the way that the Declaration has evolved as well.
And if I can say, actually, the Declaration of Independence in 1918 is called by Winston Churchill one of the three great title deeds of the English-speaking world, along with Magna Carta and the 1689 English Bill of Rights. So there is a direct connection between them, and Churchill certainly drew this out to take what had been in 1776 a treasonous document, and by 1918 state that it was one of the fundamental building blocks of the English-speaking liberal world, one of the three great title deeds.
And Michael, just for those who were less well-versed in the American Constitution and the documents that are central to it, can you just unpack the difference between the Bill of Rights, the Constitution, and the Declaration?
So the Declaration was the statement justifying the vote for independence in 1776. And it had a forward-looking element in terms of stating that the 13 now sovereign, free, and independent states, formerly colonies, could do all the things that other states could do. So they could conclude treaties, they could conduct trade, they could, of course, govern themselves. But how they would do it in a united nation was a question left open in the Declaration. There was no indication of the type of structure or government that was to be set up. That was the charge of the committee to come up with articles of confederation, not federation, but confederation, a loose alliance among these 13 free and independent states. And that those Articles of Confederation ultimately came into force in the early 1780s, 1781. They were far too weak for a nation to be formed around, and there was great fear that these United States would actually then become disunited. They might break up into different blocks, the Northeast versus the South versus the Mid-Atlantic, but that you weren't able to actually create a nation state that could deal with the exigencies of a world of imperialist powers and great powers at the time, being, of course, still Great Britain, France, Spain, and others. And so the Constitution was written essentially to refound, as we were talking about earlier, refound the United States in a much more centralized federal unit, where the great tension would be between the federal government and the sovereign states, that the states preceded the federal government. And so the Constitution sets up the framework for that government, primarily its articles focusing on the structures of government being the executive branch, the president, and the departments and offices associated with the president, who is the chief executive. The president's not supposed to initiate legislation. Rather, he is supposed to execute what legislation comes out of the second branch, the Congress. And in fact, in our Constitution, Article 1 deals with the Congress, because it was the Congress that was seen as the most important branch of government, the one, of course, closest to the people, the one that reflected the will of the state. So, for example, in the Senate initially, and in the Constitution until it was amended, the senators are picked not by the people at large in the states, but they are chosen by the state legislatures. So the Senate was supposed to reflect the interest of the states. The House of Representatives was supposed to reflect the interests of the larger people, the people at large. That was the first article. The second article dealt with the president, the chief executive, an energetic chief executive, but one who was seen still as one who carried out the legislation and the intentions of Congress. And then, of course, we had a third branch, the judiciary. But the judiciary was simply one court. It was not this broad structure that we see today of district courts and circuit courts. It was one court that we called the Supreme Court. That's the only constitutional level of the judiciary. And so everything else that we have come to know in the contemporary American system, meaning an extraordinarily powerful presidency with very powerful and until very recently, often independent parts of the executive department. There was just a Supreme Court case that has reined that in, but you know these different departments, whether the Environmental Protection Agency or the Federal Communications Commission, or these, and of course still the Federal Reserve, all of these different groups expanding over time, and therefore expanding both the power of the government, but particularly the power of the presidency. And as I mentioned, this vastly expanded judicial structure, in which you have not just a Supreme Court, but you have you have circuit courts, and then you have hundreds of district courts. All of that developed over time because of the ability within the Constitution to amend and expand the powers of the president. You couldn't take away powers, but you could expand the powers. And the first expansion of the powers of government, although it was seen as a protection against government, was what we call the Bill of Rights, the first 10 amendments, that really sought, again, to protect individual liberty. The concern of the Anti-Federalists was that the individual liberties were not protected enough under the Constitution, that you were centralizing government, even with this balance of powers and these three different branches, you were still centralizing power too much. And even though the Constitution itself says that any powers not explicitly given to the federal government are reserved for the states, there was still this fear that individual liberty would be taken away. So the first 10 are very much, you know, the famous ones, right? Freedom of religion, freedom of speech, freedom to bear arms, freedom from unreasonable search and seizure, freedom of the press, of course, The right of trial by jury, no religious test for office, all of these things that were meant to protect individual liberties. Those were the first 10, though. There are 17 that came after that. And a lot of those 17, while still preserving and protecting rights, such, for example, as abolishing slavery and ensuring the equal rights of all to vote, equal rights of women, equal rights of minorities, and specifically blacks. Nonetheless, the expansion of the amendments has, in general, expanded the powers of government to enforce those. Even if it didn't necessarily say the government can do more, but to ensure that these rights can be protected, the government, and particularly the executive, has been given extraordinary powers of enforcement. And that's been an incredible debate and balancing act between, well, if you're trying to expand the rights of individuals, but you give more power to the government to do so, how does that potentially threaten the rights of individuals? And so, for example, we see that in the what is now an over half century debate over civil rights. The Civil Rights Act of 1964 was expanded multiple times, 1965, 1968, with the Fair Housing Act, with the Voting Rights Act, even acts that didn't rise to the level of individual acts, but President Nixon's, for example, final desegregation order of schools in the South that came out in 1972, 1973. These were all acts that then had the potential, of course, of impinging on other rights and liberties of those, for example, of free association. If you say you cannot have a group that chooses its own members because that's discriminatory, then you are potentially imposing on the rights of others. This has been our eternal balancing act. All of it is framed in this way of talking about ultimately, I believe, the spirit of liberty that comes from the Declaration. I'll just give a quick example, right? The Quartering Act was such a bone of contention among the colonists that your house should be your castle, that no one should be able to come in without your right of saying so, and that in that house you should be free from unreasonable search and seizure, which is in the amendments to the Constitution. But all of that is coming out of what was originally expressed in the Declaration. So you can fast forward, to the 20th century, the late 20th century, and look at these debates, but understand that the spirit of them is actually going back to 1776.
And so, if I get this right, you have a physical expansion of the United States to its geographical extent now. And the United States is one of, perhaps the greatest product of the Enlightenment. And so you have not only this geographical expanse, but an expanse of ideas too that are not limited by time or space. So the Declaration appeals to the opinions of mankind, for example, which can be seen as a universalist claim. And I presume it was one of the first documents actually aimed at winning a battle for international legitimacy, which has carried on ever since.
As we said in the Vietnam War, we had to win the hearts and minds of, first, the American people. John Adams, later in life, in a letter, wrote that at the time of independence, only one-third of Americans were in favor, one-third were opposed, were loyalists, and in good American fashion, one-third had no opinion whatsoever. Whichever way it went was okay with them. But we forget that we were born out of division. This idea that in 1776, in July, every American was on board with independence was completely wrong. This was our first Civil War, and it was a tragic one. Tens of thousands of loyalists left, lost their properties, lost their livelihoods. They had been in America for generations. They were as American as anyone else. And they were either driven out or chose to leave. And the Declaration was in part a document designed to give hope and comfort to the patriots, that you're fighting for a reason, or your homes are being burned for a reason, and this is the reason. It was also designed to sway the undecided. You know, maybe we could get them on our side. You have to come to the right choice here, and that is to support independence and freedom, and even perhaps to peel off some of the loyalists. And so the document itself was designed to win over hearts and minds, to give a firmer base for a cause that in the summer of 1776 looked very grim. We were losing, and we were losing badly. If not for the repeated missteps of British generals, particularly William Howe, and of course others who were with him, John Burgoyne, and before him Gage, this war probably would have been over fairly quickly. And there were multiple opportunities, particularly in New York, in the fall of 1776, where the rebellion could have been crushed. But even so, after that, multiple stages where you could have delivered a body blow. And so the declaration was this rallying cry through the war to state that even though these are the times that try men's souls, as Thomas Paine put it in the winter of 1777, that there was a much grander goal for all of this. And then secondarily, as you point out, Paul, this was also designed to win over hearts and minds abroad, a decent respect for the opinions of mankind. And so it's translated right away into German because of all the German Americans, but it makes its way to Germany. Of course, it's translated into French, and it helps sway the French, to support us more openly. They had been supporting us surreptitiously, but, the Americans had to, as we say in our idiom, fish or cut bait. You can't ask for support if all you want to do is become part of Britain again, right? I mean, that's really easy. Just give up and stop the war. So in order to get this support that you need in order to win the war, you have to say what the end goal is, and the end goal is independence. So you are trying to sway those abroad. Then in the subsequent decades, the success of the revolution, the success of the declaration, makes it a rallying point for those who are now beginning their own efforts at remaking the world, or as, again, Thomas Paine put it, starting the world anew. You know, first with the French in 1789, though their revolution spins off the rails, Thomas Paine loves it, but most Americans look upon it with horror, and they say, this is not what our revolution was intended for. So the French first, but in Britain, Piedmont and Savoy are trying to get their freedom. But then really significantly through the Latin American revolutions, Mexico and Colombia and Peru and all of these states in the 1810s and 1820s, and they're referring back, they're reprinting, they're debating our declaration, along with the French declaration, to be fair, the Declaration of the Rights of Man and the Citizen. Very few of these rise to the level of the American Declaration, their own declarations that they put out. Very few of them have the philosophy that Thomas Jefferson put in. And that's the irony, is that, again, what was ignored in 1776 by the 1820s is becoming the defining element of the American Declaration. We hold these truths to be self-evident. Consent of the governed, of course. The ideas of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Pledging to each other lives, fortunes, and sacred honor, which, by the way, I believe was written into our declaration as a unifying element. Again, it's we hold these truths to be self-evident, not just the Congress or not Thomas Jefferson, but we, the American people, through their representatives, or crucially, I think, pledging to each other their lives, their fortunes, and their sacred honor, which the signers did. They didn't pledge it to the new nation. They didn't pledge it to their sovereign and free and independent states. They pledged it to each other, even though these were very different men, Puritans versus Cavaliers, versus backwoods farmers versus rich merchants, but they pledged to each other. It was a unity claim. And when the Declaration is translated abroad and adopted or not adopted, but, you know, influenced so many of these other revolutionary movements, often that part of it is missing. It's still one group against another, and it doesn't often rise to the level of the Enlightenment philosophy, which, as you point out, America is probably the greatest example of Enlightenment in action or Enlightenment in the real world. You know, that was a claim that Henry Steele Commager, a very famous mid-20th century historian, wrote an entire book on that, stating, you know, that the Enlightenment was born in Europe, but it was realized in America. And fascinatingly, it is realized as the country expands. You mentioned that geographical expansion. The Declaration is an enduring and ever-present element of the expansion across the continent. And, you know, you can go back. George Washington was worried that the communities west of our Appalachian mountain chain, which really sort of separates the East Coast from, you know, the rest of the country, from the Midwest, certainly. And then, of course, you have the Rockies, which separate the far west. But George Washington was worried that the communities west of the Appalachians had very good reason for separating themselves from the rest of the states, that they would be more drawn to the Mississippi Valley. That's where their trade would go. And then therefore they would be more likely to join France or Spain, you know, whoever was controlling the area at the time. And so part of the constitutional settlement, of course, was the idea that you could have new states created. This is particularly expressed before the Constitution in the Northwest Ordinance, that you can have new states created out of territories if they meet certain conditions, and so the political institutional structure is expanding as the nation expands. And by the way, uniquely, that those new states would be, if they were brought into the Union, if they met the qualifications and then Congress agreed to make these territory states, they would be equal to all the other states. They would be equal to Massachusetts. They would be equal to Virginia. It didn't matter that, you know, Virginia was settled in 1607 first, and that Illinois, my home state, would become a state over 200 years later in 1818. Illinois would be equal to Virginia. That's what really kept the Union together. But then at each stage, and I go through it in the book, each of these communities immediately adopted the traditions and history of the states from which, of course, many of the settlers had come. But they are reading and celebrating the Declaration of Independence in these tiny communities out on the Great Plains or on the Mississippi River, stating that we have not just the same rights, but the same responsibilities as our older brethren back east. And so the Declaration follows the frontier.
And just as the American people go on this journey over the last 250 years, what becomes the American people now, the document itself goes on an extraordinary physical journey. I wonder if you could just give us a brief, very short history of just that journey that the actual document itself went on.
I'll try. You know, it's hard for me to be brief, but I'll do my best. So first, just to very quickly, what we think of as the first declaration is not the famous one in the National Archives today, which, by the way, we're taping this on August 3rd, 2026. Yesterday, August 2nd, 2026, marked the 250th anniversary of the signing of that document. It was not signed on July 4th. It didn't exist on July 4th. What existed on July 4th, the evening of July 4th, were what we call broadsides. You can see them over my shoulder on either side. One of them, the one on this side, was at my left shoulder, was printed on July 4th, about 200 copies, and sent out throughout the colonies. It's what we call the Dunlap broadside from John Dunlap, the printer. Only 26 of those remain today. What you see behind me in the middle, what we call the engrossed declaration, the handwritten, inscribed declaration, was not even thought of until the middle of July, and then wasn't ready for signing until August, August 2nd, as I mentioned, which was a process, by the way. It didn't happen at once. It took weeks and months, and in some cases, some claimed it took years for them to put their signatures on it. And then when that beautifully, beautifully written out document was signed, it was just rolled up. It was a state paper of Congress. Nobody knew that it existed. And then in 1789, when the Constitution came into effect and the federal government was formed, it was then transferred to the State Department. But from the moment of its signing, that beautiful parchment was at risk. And it was carted around as Congress fled the British between 1776 and 1801, 25 years, the first 25 years of its life. It had 18 different homes. It was moved around, and it wasn't moved around carefully. It wasn't moved around with special protection or special cases or with climate control. You know, they didn't have any of that. They didn't know it. It was simply thrown into sacks or chests and put on carts and rumbled around these terrible roads with humidity and rain and cold. And it was terribly beaten up. And in fact, it shouldn't even exist today. It's just a miracle it exists, which is why if you go, which I hope everyone who listens has the opportunity to go this year and go see it. It's in terrible condition. You can barely read it. And partly that was because of how it was treated for these first 25 years. And partly because it was also so popular. It became so popular in the 19th century. After 1814, it was saved by the skin of its teeth from being incinerated when the British burned the White House complex, which included the Department of State. It was roughly thrown into a linen sack, carted 40 miles away, and thrown into a cellar where it was on a unguarded in the summer heat in a cellar for weeks until we were sure that the British had left the area of Washington, D.C. When that story comes out and gets known, Americans are fascinated that the Declaration survived, and yet they say, what survived? Because they didn't even know this parchment existed. It was kept secret, not secret, but it was kept, as a paper of state. And then they want to see it. So now people are coming and asking to see it. So it's unrolled and rolled and unrolled and rolled so many times that finally in 1841, Daniel Webster, the famous Secretary of State and more famous as a senator, sends it to the equivalent of the British Museum, what was called our National Museum or our National Gallery, to put it up for people finally to see. And then it's hanging in the sunlight, and so it's fading more. It's not until 150 years after it's signed in 1951 that the Declaration gets its first true scientific treatment with a true scientific case, climate controls, special environment of helium, humidity sensors, all the things that today protect it. Took 150 years for this document to actually be properly protected and cared for.
And those who have seen it, I've been lucky enough to see it myself, know that there's a very sacred element to it. It feels like, and I'm sure it is, particularly for Americans, a kind of religious experience in a way. But whatever the truth of this Enlightenment document, its words had wings. I think you've convinced us of that, Michael. And I think you've also convinced us that the Declaration of Independence really did make America its remarkable story. And I recommend Michael's book, National Treasure, How the Declaration of Independence Made America. It's out now. It's a terrific read. And I think we've just given you a flavour now, or at least Michael has. So thank you very much, Mark Loslin. It's been a great pleasure to listen to your thoughts. Thank you.
It's my pleasure, Paul. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you for listening to the EI podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please sign up to our mailing list and download the Engelsberg Ideas app. Explore intelligent perspectives on history, culture, and geopolitics anytime, anywhere. And best of all, it's totally free. Until next time, thanks for listening.